Well, as were various representations of the Green Man. Perry raised his eyebrows. Open the second register? Think we're going to be that busy? I nodded. I have a feeling it's going to be an unusual day. In truth, I simply didn't want him behind the apothecary counter where Oberon was hiding. If you get some downtime, see if you can create an end display for the tarot cards. Maybe we can sell some more that way.
Putting them out like that will make them easier to shoplift.
I shrugged. I'm not worried about it. I wasn't. Everything in the store had the same binding spell on it that I had put on Fragora in my backyard. Nothing could go out the door unless it had first been placed on the counter next to one of the registers. More than one would-be thief had been forcibly pulled back into the store by the items in his pocket.
Okay, I'll go turn on the music. Celtic pipes?
Nah, let's do some guitar this morning. That Mexican duo, Rodrigo y Gabriela.
Right.
Perry headed toward the back of the store where the sound system was, and I filled a couple of kettles in the sink and put them on to boil. A couple of regulars would be coming in as soon as we unlocked the door, so it was best to have the water ready. I glanced over at the paper racks and saw that Perry had already filled them. Some Spanish guitar came on through the sound system, its world beat suggesting to customers that here they could not only find refuge from corporate radio, but also much else that was stale and prepackaged and bereft of mystery. Perry strode back to the door, brandishing his keys, and said,
"Okay to open?"
And I nodded at him. The first person to walk through the door was my daytime lawyer, Holbjorn Hoke. He used the name Hal for modern American usage. He was dressed in a dark blue pinstripe suit with a white shirt and pale yellow tie. His hair, as ever, was immaculately styled in a Joe Buck haircut, and the dimple in his chin smiled sideways at me. If I didn't know he was a werewolf, I would have voted for him.
"Have you seen the morning papers, Atticus?"
he said without preamble.
"Not yet," I admitted.
"Good morning to you, Mr. Hauk."
"Right. Well, then perhaps you'd better take a look."
He grabbed a copy of the Arizona Republic and slapped it down forcefully on the counter in front of me, pointing to a headline on the right-hand column.
"Now tell me, lad,"
he said in his best faux Irish accent tinged with ancient Icelandic.
"Would you be knowing anything about this spot of trouble here?"
The headline read, "Ranger Found Dead in Papago Park." Casting off my American accent, I replied in kind,
"I'd be knowing more than is comfortable, just between me and me attorney-client privilege."
"I thought as much. I heard Coyote laughing last night, and he doesn't laugh at the harmless, does he now?"
"No, he doesn't, sir. I might be needing your help sooner rather than later."
"Right. I'll be seeing you for lunch then at Rue La Boule."
He named the Irish pub at the north end of Mill Avenue that was my favorite hangout.
"I'm thinking it's high time we had ourselves a heart-to-heart, and there's no reason it shouldn't be had over the best fish and chips in 30 states."
I nodded and said,
"At high noon, sir."
Though I could not figure where he had pulled the number 30 from. Which 20 states had better fish and chips than Rue La Boule? He had evidently been paying more attention to fish and chip cuisine than I had, and I must admit that I felt a twang of guilt. The finest fish and chips in the land was more than a mere trivial pursuit for me, and I had sorely neglected it for an abominably long time. Most places excelled in either one or the other, but rare was the establishment that paid equal attention to both sides of the culinary compliment. Rue La Boule was one of the few Irish pubs that savored the chip as well as the fish, and its presence had been a determining factor in my decision to grow roots in Tempe.
"Right," he said. "See you then."
And he exited without another word. My senior regulars came in. Sophie, Arnie, Joshua, and Penelope. Joshua grabbed a newspaper and pointed out the same article Hal had shown me.
"God, would you look at this?" he said, waving at it. "It's like we're back in New York."
He said almost the same thing every day about one article or another, so I was oddly comforted by it. A lone searcher arrived, seeking something that wasn't Judeo-Christian, and buying a primer series in Buddhism, Hinduism, and Wicca. "May harmony find you," I said, and he dipped his head to me as he left. He had my respect. At least he wasn't content to be fed the diet on the television. And then something unusual walked through my door. She was a witch. Her personal wards radiated warnings, and even though I was not adept enough to know what they did or what they protected her from,
I knew by her aura what she was. I hastily muttered a binding under my breath to keep all my hairs on my body. Witches could do some pretty heinous stuff with hair, blood, or even nail clippings, and I didn't know yet if she was friendly or not. Her appearance marked her as nothing more than a trendy college student, however. No black robes or pointy hat, no hairy moles growing on the end of an oversized nose. She had her brown hair pulled back in a ponytail, as carefully considered a decision as the makeup applied to her face and the pink gloss on her lips. She was wearing a white bebe tank top and a pair of oversized white-rimmed sunglasses. She carried a pink cell phone in one hand along with a jangling key ring. Her tanned, silky legs were bare beyond a pair of turquoise cotton shorts that strained at the boundaries of modesty. Her feet were slipped into a pair of pink flip-flops, her toenails painted pink with golden glitter sparkling in it. She took a moment to look around, inspecting the unseen more than the seen, before she turned and strode to my apothecary's counter. She appeared to be my assumed age, 21 or so, but I knew how deceiving appearances could be. I could not tell her true age without more information, but the eyes behind those sunglasses were definitely older than 21. She had seen things that separated her from the young and stupid. Still, she was less than a century old, judging by her aura, because it was still fluid and had none of the telltale markers of the truly old. If she could perceive the bindings around my shop and within them, she knew I was much older than I looked, too.
"Are you the owner of the shop?"
she said, approaching my counter. "I am. What can I do for you?"
"You are Atticus O'Sullivan?"
"Uh-huh." I nodded once. Someone had told her whom to ask for. I did not put my name on the window.
"I've heard that you can brew some extraordinary teas."
"Well, yeah, I can make you some oolong with an antioxidant booster that's simply awesome. Would you like a cup of that?"
"That does sound fabulous, but that's not the sort of tea I'm talking about."
"Oh. Then what you looking for?"
"I need a tea that will humble a man who is attracted to me, make me unattractive to him."
"What? Wait, you wish to be unattractive?"
"To this one particular man, yes. Can you brew such a tea?"
"You want a sort of anti-Viagra, if I'm hearing you right."
"You have understood me perfectly."
I shrugged. "It ought to be possible." She smiled. Her teeth were very white and straight, a toothpaste commercial waiting to happen. "But how did you hear about me?"
"I am one of Radomiwa's coven," she said, extending her hand to shake. "The youngest, actually. My name is Amelia, but I go by Emily in America."
I relaxed a little bit. Radomiwa and I had a professional and cordial relationship. She was the leader of the Tempe Coven, 13 witches who actually knew what the hell they were doing. They had a fancier name for themselves than that, but they didn't advertise it. Radomiwa was pretty powerful, and I would rather not get on her bad side. Oh, one-on-one I'd probably be able to dispatch her, but then her entire coven would come after me together, and they would chew me up and tell the Morrigan to go suck on it, because they most likely had their own goddess in their corner. "Why do you need me, Emily?" I asked, shaking her hand once and knowing she was trying to gauge my power through the contact. That didn't work too well on druids. We draw our power from the earth as needed, so she probably felt nothing more than the low-level power I was using to maintain Oberon's camouflage. It had caused more than one foe to underestimate me, so that was fine by me. I'm not into peacock displays of power. Isn't Radomiwa capable of looking after her own coven anymore? For that matter, you could take care of this problem yourself. You don't need me.
That is true, she said. But Radomiwa wants no part in the crafting of this particular potion. Neither do I. We require outside assistance.
And so you came here. I'm just a friendly apothecary who knows that witches are for real.
I pray you do not fence with me. I know full well what you are, druid.
Well, that was putting the cards on the table. I took another look at her aura, which was largely red and tossed about with the desire for power. She might be older than a century after all. College students these days didn't begin their sentences with, "I pray you," and they thought fencing was selling stolen car stereos. And I know what you are too, Emily of the Sisters of the Three Auroras. Her mouth formed a tiny O of surprise at my use of her coven's true name. If you don't want to humble this guy yourself, then I don't want to either.
If you would agree to this thing, then Radomiwa and her coven would be in your debt,
Emily said. I arched an eyebrow. Are you authorized to commit Radomiwa to such a pledge?
I am,
she said, and pushed a note across the counter to me. It was in Radomiwa's hand, and the splatter beneath it was Radomiwa's blood. Even dried, I could see the power in it. Oh yes, she had authorization. I snatched the note off the counter and pushed it down into my pocket. Very well, I said. I will agree to make this tea against your coven's pledge of future favor, provided that you personally agree to follow my instructions to the letter and pay my customary fees. She bristled a little bit, obviously expecting the note to take care of everything, but eventually she nodded curtly.
Agreed, she said.
Very well, I smiled. How long do you wish to remain unattractive to this man?
A week should suffice.
Then you will appear here tomorrow at this hour to drink a tea I will prepare for you, and every day thereafter for a week. Failure to appear will void our contract with no monies refunded.
I understand and agree.
Tomorrow you'll bring me a cashier's check for $10,000. Her eyes widened.
Outrageous!
She spat, and she had a point. I never charged more than $200 for my apothecary services.
That cannot be your customary fee.
If the Tempe Coven is unwilling to take care of your paramour's libido on its own, which they could do far more simply than I, then I am owed danger pay, I said.
But not that much?
She fumed, all but admitting the danger was real. I produced the note and offered it to her. Then I bid you good day. Emily's shoulders sagged.
You bargain well, she said,
her eyes downcast to my countertop. Her hands made no move to take back the note, but I kept it raised within her reach. You will bring me the cashier's check tomorrow, then? I asked.
Aye, she said,
and with that I put the note back in my pocket. Then we'll begin tomorrow.
Not now?
Until I have the check, no.
Then, if I bring the check today, you will begin?
Aye, Emily, that is the contract I propose.
And once begun, you will not renege?
It was an unusual request to put so bluntly, but not an unreasonable one. All contracts should allow the customer a reasonable expectation of completion, but it seemed an awful lot of trouble to go through to make one guy go limp for a week. You have my word, Emily, that once payment is received, I shall execute the contract as stated, so long as you appear daily at the same hour to drink my tea. She spat in her hand and extended it to me.
Contract offered?
I stared at her hand and made no move to take it. If I spat in mine and shook her hand, then she would have some of my spittle to work with. Giving a witch your body fluids is akin to slicing off a choice cut of your buttocks and offering it to a werewolf. Received, I said, keeping my hands on the counter. You may consider my word my bond. She smiled triumphantly, not in the least offended, and exited my shop without feigning interest in any of my wares, though she pointedly waved at Oberon behind the counter and said,
Bye, puppy.
Just to show me she had seen through the camouflage. And I wondered, far too late, whether I had behaved wisely in agreeing to this business. Probably not. Witches had better ways of controlling their bodies than drinking a druid's brews, and if they were willing to put their entire coven in magical hawk to me and pay me 10,000 ducats to boot to get rid of one horny guy, then I was probably dealing with an incubus or something similarly nasty. The magic of attraction is little more than science these days. I would brew her a blend of herbs that would suppress her natural pheromones, which were currently exciting the fella, and then, with a bit of clever binding, cause her to emit the chemical signature of a skunk instead. Unless this guy was a closet skunkophile, she'd be looking at a wet noodle all night. On top of that, I was going to make sure she didn't get excited either, throwing in some natural monoamine suppressants. I had made this sort of brew before. I sold it to sorority girls as humility. They used it on their exes or their stalkers, or sometimes to end a relationship when they had no good reason to do so. Back when I first learned how to make a tea like this, I didn't have names for all the chemical reactions caused by the herbs. The herb lore was just as magical to me as my bindings were to a layperson. Science had taken away some of the mystery of the process, but none of the utter coolness I felt knowing that I could whip up compounds the pharmaceutical industry could only dream of. But I will not pretend I was helping Emily to feel cool. I figured to come out far ahead in the deal, because having a coven in your debt was serious mojo, and I could use plenty of that if the Morrigan's casting were to come true. Chapter 8. It actually turned out to be quite a busy morning, making my opening of the second register seem like genius. Perry never found time to mess with the tarot display until much later, and I never got time to read the full article about the park ranger, but I figured Hal would fill me in once I got to Rulabula. "Come on, Oberon, lunchtime."
"Burgers?"
He lifted his head up hopefully. "Fish, and we're going to be in a restaurant, so you need to behave and stay out of the way."
"Same rules wherever we go. Behave and stay out of the way."
I waved at Perry and told him I'd be back in an hour or so. "Mind the fortress, will you?" He waved back. "No problem." I slipped out the door and opened it wide so Oberon could follow me, then unlocked my bike from the stand and hopped on. "No stopping to smell the trees and fire hydrants," I said. "I can't be calling back to an invisible dog every few minutes to hurry it up."
"When do I get to have some fun?"
he whined. "After I close up shop. You can play around at the widow's house. You can chase her cats in camouflage and totally freak them out." Oberon made chuffing noises, which was the canine equivalent of laughter.
Oh, now that sounds like a good time. I can sneak up on that calico one and bark right behind it. It'll hit the ceiling."
We chuckled about it together as we made our way up Mill Avenue, passing the bars and boutiques and the occasional gallery. Oberon told me about his plans to just put his paw down on the Persian's tail and watch what happened. Hal Hauk had already secured a table inside Rulabula near the window, and he had ordered a pint of Smittix for each of us. I was both pleased and disappointed by the gesture, for it meant I wouldn't get to go to the bar myself and take a whiff of the barmaid. That's not as creepy as it sounds. Granuaile, the red-headed siren behind Rulabula's bar, was not entirely human, but I still didn't know what she was, and her scent was my only clue. She was a mystery to me, and a beautiful one at that. Long locks of curly red hair cascaded over her shoulders, which were always covered in a tight but otherwise chaste t-shirt. She did not earn tips from her cleavage, like many barmaids do, but rather depended on her green eyes, her pouty lips, and the light dusting of freckles on her cheeks. She had pale, creamy skin and a few fine golden hairs on her arms, which led eventually to fingernails she had painted green to match her eyes. She was not one of the Fae. I could see through all their glamours, and in any case she never blanched at my iron amulet. Neither was she undead, or she would hardly be working the day shift. She wasn't aware of any kind, which Hal had mentioned, but I had already determined using my own methods. I had thought she might be a witch, but she didn't have the telltale signs in her aura. If she had been anything sent from hell, I would have smelled the brimstone, but instead she gave off an ineffable scent that was not quite floral, more like a Pinot Grigio and mixed in with something that reminded me of India, like saffron and poppies. I was left to conclude that she was a goddess of some sort, masking her true nature and slumming here incognito, like so many other members of the supernatural community, displaced from points all over the world. The Bonnie Irish Lass facade was even more shameless than mine, for I doubted that she was truly Irish underneath it all. She must be from some foreign pantheon, and I was determined to figure it out without asking her a thing. She flashed a smile at me as I walked in, and my heart sped up a bit. Did she have a clue as to my true nature, or did she only see the dim college kid disguise? Her face fell as I walked past the bar toward Hal's table.
"You're not sitting with me today, Atticus,"
she said with a pout, and I almost changed course right there.
"Down, boy,"
Oberon said at my heels with ironic relish. I ignored him. "Sorry, Granuaile." That simply could not be her true name. She had to have picked it out on purpose to fit in at an Irish bar. "I have to talk a little treason with my friend," I said, gesturing toward Hal. She smiled.
"If it's a conspiracy, I want in on it. I can keep a secret."
"I'll bet you can," I said, and she arched an eyebrow at me. I felt a foolish grin spread across my face.
"Ahem! Time is money, Mr. O'Sullivan," Hal called,
and I snapped my head around, suddenly realizing I had stopped in the middle of the bar and forgotten what I was doing there. Hal's time was worth $350 an hour.
Next time you take me to the dog park and you yell at me to stay away from the French poodles, I'm going to remind you of this, Oberon said.
Embarrassed, I stalked over to Hal's table and sat myself across from him. Oberon squeezed underneath the table next to the window and waited for food to rain down from the sky. Hal frowned.
I smell your dog.
He's under the table, camouflaged, I said. Hal's eyes widened as he processed the sling across my chest and the hilt peeking out over my shoulder.
Is that the sword I think it is? He asked.
Yes, I replied, and took a long pull from the smithix.
Was it employed in last night's mischief?
No, but I believe in being prepared. There's more trouble on the way, a whole lot more.
Do I need to tell the pack?
Hal asked.
Werewolves, their pack always came first.
Hey, it's my ass and the meat grinder here, not the packs, I said. You don't need to tell anyone but Leif about this business. In fact, I want to see him as soon as he wakes up tonight. Send him to my house. Hal looked as if I had just asked him to lick up vomit.
Will you be paying the firm for his time, or will he?
He was referring to the business arrangement I had with the vampire. Leif and I had a unique understanding. Sometimes I paid cash for his services, and sometimes I paid him in fine liqueur. That is to say, my blood. I had carefully neglected to mention that to Flitish. The blood of a 2,100-year-old human, and a druid no less, was a powerful, intoxicating, and extremely rare vintage for a vampire. I slashed my arm, drained a wine glass full for him, and then healed myself, and that was worth 12 hours billing to him. Then I washed out the glass and made sure he hadn't spilled any, because I was paranoid about my blood getting into the hands of witches. He paid the firm out of his own pocket for such a drink, and he had grown powerful over the years by it. I never saw him use the power, because nothing locally wanted to mess with him, but I think Leif was trying to become strong enough to mess with Thor someday.
Does it matter? I said.
The firm gets paid either way. Our waitress arrived, and we paused to order 3 plates of fish and chips. The third was for Oberon, who was doing a good job of remaining invisible. When she left, Hal spread his hands and said,
Okay, tell me everything.
I told him about Flitish, but left out the Morrigan. It wasn't everything, but close enough.
So a goddess from your pantheon has come and gone, he said when I had finished. And you could get a visit from 2 more Irish gods before this business is through?
Right. Angus Og and Bress. Plus Firbolgs.
Plus those. I've never seen one. What are they like?
To you, they'll look like a biker gang or something similar, but they'll smell like shit.
Biker gangs can smell like shit sometimes.
Well, that just makes the disguise better, I said. The point is, you won't see what they're really like, because they wear glamour when they walk in the mortal world. In truth, they're giants with bad oral hygiene and a predilection for wielding spears. They used to be an independent people in the old days, but the Tuatha De Danann used them as thugs now.
How much of a threat are they?
To my life, I'm not particularly worried. I'm more worried about collateral damage than anything else.
That will bring the police into it.
Which I'm sure is the point of sending them. Firbolgs are not renowned for their discretion. Our fish and chips arrived, and I sighed happily. It is life's small, simple pleasures that make it worth living longer than a century or two. I dropped a piece of cod down to Oberon and covered up his noisy chomping sounds with some noises of my own.
So, how can I keep Oberon from going to animal control?
I asked around a mouthful of chips and beer. Hal shrugged.
The simplest way is to do what you're doing and lie, he replied. Keep him hidden and tell anyone who asks that he escaped and ran away. In a month, or even less, they'll be so swamped with other cases that they won't be able to keep tabs on whether he's with you or not. Then you'll tell all your neighbors you've given up. You're going to get a new dog, and voila, Oberon reappears. Oh, and I wouldn't go hunting in the Papago Hills for a year or so.
Oberon whined at that, and I hushed him by dropping another piece of cod on the floor.
This is all supposing the police actually track him to your place, Hal said. They haven't shown up yet, have they?
I shook my head. Not yet, but since I think someone is leading them around, I have no doubt they will show up soon. Now tell me what to do if I don't want to lie. Hal stopped chewing and regarded me steadily for a few seconds.
You don't want to lie?
He said, completely off his guard. Of course I do. I just want to know what else I can do that I haven't thought of already. That's why I pay you, Hal. I mean, shit, come on. Hal smiled.
You really sound like one of these modern kids. I have no idea how you do it.
Blending in is the best survival skill I have. It's just listening carefully and parroting, really. So tell me what to do if I'm forced to play it honest.
Honest as in the police can see through your camouflage spell and know that Oberon is right in front of them?
Sure. Pretend I'm an ordinary guy with no magic at my disposal. Then how do I protect Oberon? The werewolf took a long drink of Smittix and belched discreetly as he thought about it. Then he placed his hands flat on the table and said,
Well, the only way they'd be able to build a case without witnesses is to use DNA matching. Oberon has no rights, but as his owner, you can demand they get a warrant before they do the whole unreasonable search and seizure thing. If they come with a warrant, though, you pretty much have to let them do what they want. And judging from what you've told me, if they get a DNA sample from him, the case will be pretty solid.
That's right, I said, nodding.
Well, another way we can delay things is to lodge some protest on religious grounds.
How's that?
You protest against the DNA testing of your dog on the grounds that it's against your religion.
I looked at him as if he were trying to sell me the ShamWow and the Slap Chop for only $19.99 plus shipping and handling. My religion has no objection to DNA testing. We didn't know what the hell DNA was in the Iron Age.
Hal shrugged. They don't know that.
Neither of us would ever get an award for ethics.
The Iron Age, huh?
Hal had been trying to guess my age for a good while, and I had carelessly given him another clue. I ignored his query and frowned skeptically. Will that argument work?
No, the judge will throw it out on the grounds that your dog cannot possibly share your religious views, or something like that. But it will delay things for a good long while, long enough for you to figure out where to hide Oberon, if, as you say in this entirely hypothetical situation, you can't do it magically.
Good show, old sod,
I said in a cheerful accent straight out of Piccadilly Circus.
I knew there was a jolly good solicitor in you somewhere.
Oh, bugger off,
Hal replied in kind.
Just hide and lie and keep it simple for everyone, all right?
I grinned at him. Will do. Where's the pack going to run next full moon?
In the White Mountains near Greer. Did you want to come along?
Occasionally the pack would let Oberon and me run with them, and it was always a good time. The only touchy part was my status within the group, because werewolves are obsessed with status. Magnuson didn't like to have me along because technically he'd have to be submissive to me, if I gave a damn about such things, and alphas aren't comfortable showing any kind of submission in front of their packs. I couldn't blame him, of course, so we worked out a compromise where I was a friend of the pack, a guest on equal footing with every member, essentially outside their hierarchy, and that kept everyone's hackles from rising. But it also meant that Hawk, not Magnuson, had to be my lawyer. As a second, he was already submissive and did not have to worry about debasing himself by serving my legal needs.
I would love to, but it falls around Samhain, and I have some of my own rituals to attend to, I said.
I thank you for the offer, though.
My pleasure.
He extended a hand across the table to me. I shook it, and he said,
I'll take care of this bill and let Leif know you want to see him when he wakes for the night. You call me if you need anything else, and stay away from that red-headed bartender. I don't know what she is besides trouble.
That's like asking a bee to stay away from flowers. I grinned back at him. Thanks, Hal. Give my regards to the pack. Come on, Oberon. We both rose and headed for the door. Grognewail waved at me and smiled.
Come back soon and see me, Atticus,
she called.
I will, I promised. You don't even know if she really likes you, Oberon said as we exited and I unlocked my bike. She could be doing her customer service routine and stringing you along in hopes of a big tip the next time you come in. With dogs you just go up and smell their asses and you know where you stand. It's so much easier. Why can't humans do that?
Perhaps if we had a better sense of smell we would, I said. Nature clearly favored your kind in that regard. When I returned to the store and told Perry he could take off for lunch, Emily the Witch was already there waiting for me, drinking a cup of chamomile tea Perry had made for her. He wasn't skilled behind the tea station, but he could boil some water and pour it on top of pre-made sachets as long as I labeled them carefully. "Back so soon?" I said. "You must be eager to begin."
"True enough," she said.
She stood from the table and minced over to me in her affected Barbie doll stride. She waved a check at me before placing it in my hand and saying snarkily,
"Here's your danger pay, though there's nothing dangerous about making some tea. I never figured druids would be so avaricious."
I took it from her hand and made a show of examining it carefully, because I knew it would annoy her. She deliberately tried to provoke me, and one cannot sass me with impunity. I saw her face flush and knew she wanted to say something about my dilatory manner, but she wisely kept her mouth shut and contained herself to huffing. Eventually I said,
"This appears to be in order. I will begin your treatment because your coven has done right by me in the past,
but if this fails to clear the bank, then of course that will be a breach of contract. Now, that was just unnecessary, even insulting, for me to say, but she was such a snot I felt she deserved it."
"Fine," she ground out, and I smiled and went behind my counter to begin brewing her tea.
I worked in silence for a while. We were the only people in the store, and neither of us was in the mood to make small talk. Oberon picked up on it.
"Genghis Khan would never put up with so much attitude," he said.
"You speak the truth, my friend, but I'm as guilty as she is. We are not being very nice to each other."
"So I gathered. But why not? Isn't she the sort of female you normally find attractive?"
"If that was really what she looked like, sure," I said. "But in reality, she's probably pushing 90 or so, and besides, I don't trust witches."
"You think she's going to try something? Should I move behind her?"
"No, she knows you're here. She can see through the camouflage. But I think she's hiding something from me, and I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop."
"When did she drop the first shoe? I missed it."
"Never mind. Just listen. Once she drinks the tea, she will try to surprise me with something. She's waiting for the contract to be fully in effect before she says anything."
"Well then, give her back the check and send her back in. We don't need to play her witch's games. They always want to get you and your little dog, too."
"I knew I never should have let you watch The Wizard of Oz."
"Toto didn't deserve that kind of trauma. He was so tiny."
When Emily's tea was finished steeping, I set it on the counter for her. "Drink it as is," I said. "No sweeteners, and nothing sugary for at least 3 hours afterward. Be careful from this day forward not to eat anything for 3 hours before drinking this tea either. Insulin will interfere with metabolizing the medicinal compounds in the tea." That was complete bunk. I just made that up to mess with her. "And it'll take a couple of hours for the results to show up, so don't go hopping into his bed right away."
"Fine," she said,
and she began chugging the tea as if it were an Irish car bomb, completely disregarding the damage the hot liquid might do to her tongue and throat. She really wanted to get this over with. She slammed it down forcefully, as if it were a shot glass instead of a teacup, and she smiled malevolently at me.
"And now, Druid, now that you have entered into a contract from which you cannot withdraw without severe consequences, I have the pleasure of informing you that the man you're rendering impotent with this brew is none other than Angus Og."
Chapter 9. Now, that was a pretty good bomb to drop on me. It raised all sorts of questions. Foremost among them, where is Angus Og right now? If he was already in town and diddling the local witches to pass the time, then my paranoia was well justified. It meant he was far more directly involved in last night's mischief than I had thought. And it meant something else, which Emily was obviously waiting for me to realize. Providing her with the agent for his humiliation would make Angus Og duty-bound to kill me as soon as possible. He would no longer feel comfortable in taking the occasional pot shot at me from a distance. He'd have to actively hunt me down and make me pay. Yep, storm clouds are thrice cursed. First the Fae found out where I was hiding, then my dog killed a human, and now I'd earned the very personal enmity of a god who had been content for centuries to simply let his minions slap me around. Emily wasn't going to get an expression of even mild concern from me, though. She wanted to see terror in my eyes, but I walled that all off and pretended she was talking about someone harmless, like Snuffleupagus or Captain Kangaroo. "So you've come to me to make him wilt like lettuce," I said. "You could have done the job yourself by shedding that skin and showing him what you really look like." Wow. I couldn't believe I just said that. Her eyes bulged with the offense, and she whipped her right hand toward my face for a slap. Now, a slap from a normal woman I could handle. Heck, I'd suggest I needed one after saying something like that to a regular college kid. But a slap from a witch is simply not permissible, because sure as the moon rises full once a month, she'd use her nails to scrape some skin off my cheek, perhaps even draw some blood, and then she'd have me. A friend of mine fell prey to precisely this sort of trick centuries ago, and it had poisoned me against witches ever since. She had goaded him into saying something rude, slapped him, and left marks on his face. And then that very night his heart exploded inside his chest. I don't mean he had a heart attack. His heart had literally blown apart as if someone had planted explosives in it, long before gunpowder was invented. Some other druids and I had taken him to the grove and done a rudimentary autopsy to see if we could puzzle out why he'd dropped dead so abruptly, and we found this crater inside his ribcage. That's when I realized he'd been killed the moment she slapped him. I'd never avenged him. The witch got away, and it still stung centuries later. That's why Emily's attempt to slap me got a very violent reaction. I knocked her arm down by crossing my right hand over my face, then I backhanded her really hard, much harder than I should have. I shouldn't have hit her at all. I should have just backed up out of her reach, but I tend to flare up when people try to kill me, which was what she was trying to do, make no mistake. She squealed and staggered back a few steps, holding her nose. I had broken it, and I sort of felt like an asshole, even though she had planned to do much worse to me. While she was still in shock and processing what had happened, I took the opportunity to try to talk her down from escalating it. "You offered me violence, and I defended myself. I know that a slap from you would have meant the end of my life, or at least the threat of it, and I could not permit that. And if you're thinking about using magic against me in my own shop, I would remind you that discretion is sometimes the better part of valor."
"And I would remind you that I am not powerless. Radomiwa will hear of this."
"That's fine. I'll show her my security tape," I said, gesturing to the video camera mounted on the wall above the register, "which clearly shows you swinging first. On top of that, you have now given me cause to believe you are a close associate of an old enemy of mine. I'd be within my rights to treat you as hostile."
"Go ahead and try something," she challenged, eyes blazing.
"I don't need to try anything," I chuckled. "I'm in control here."
"You go on thinking you're in control, druid,"
she spat, heading for the door in a fury, her flip-flops flapping noisily.
"You'll soon find out you are very mistaken."
"See you tomorrow for tea," I waved cheerily as she slammed through my door.
"Oh, she's gonna want some revenge,"
Oberon said after the door closed and we were alone. "Don't worry about her," I said, grabbing a spoon and moving quickly around the counter. "She's not the sharpest tool in the shed."
"What are you doing?"
Oberon asked. He followed me out to the floor, curious. I had squatted down on my haunches, examining the carpet. "Ah, there we go." I found a droplet of blood on the carpet that hadn't soaked thoroughly into the weave. It was not much, but it would be enough. I scraped it off the surface and walked toward the door, peering through the glass window to see if Emily was visible. She was getting into her car, parked across the street a short distance north, a bright yellow Volkswagen Beetle. She would have to turn over her left shoulder to see me, so I darted outside, telling Oberon I'd return in a moment, and kicked off my sandals. I sank my toes into the same narrow strip of grass that had helped me heal my arm the day before, and I chanted a binding as I drew power from the earth. Emily felt the draw somehow, whipped her head around, and saw me standing there. I showed the spoon to her and smiled. Her mouth dropped open in horror as she realized how careless she had been. I saw her lips move and her brow furrow in concentration, so I had no time to waste. I licked her blood off the spoon and completed the binding just in time. She flicked her fingers at me, and I knew she had just hurled something my way, but all I felt was a gentle breeze. A couple of seconds later, her upper body was thrown painfully forward into her steering wheel, which caused the car's horn to beep. Ha! She had tried to blow the spoon out of my hand and knock me down in the process, off the grass strip and my source of power. Clever, but not fast enough. The binding I had performed was actually a ward, which meant that any spell she sent against me would rebound against her. The only way she could get out of it would be to get herself some new blood. She leaned back slowly and clutched her chest, probably bruised a rib or two. On top of a broken nose and wounded pride, she'd had a rough day visiting the local druid. It made me wonder what she'd been told about me. Did she know how old I was? Did she think I was some sort of lame-ass neo-druid, mucking about with holly branches and mistletoe? She turned around to stare daggers at me, and I gave her a jovial wave, then blew her a kiss. She flipped me off, a gesture that had zero cultural relevance to me, and then started up her beetle and screeched away toward University Drive. Chuckling to myself, I re-entered the store, and Oberon came over and nuzzled against my legs, which was somewhat startling when he was in camouflage.
"Nobody's here now. I want to scratch behind the ears."
I searched and found his head and gave him a good head rub for a minute or so. "Yes, you've been very patient, haven't you?" I said. "Tell you what, next time we go hunting, we'll head down to the Chiricahua Mountains. That's south of here, and I think you'll like it."
"What's down there?"
"Mule deer. Maybe some of those bighorn sheep if we get lucky."
"When can we go?"
"Probably not until this business is over," I admitted. "I know it'll be a long wait for you, but I promise we'll do nothing but hunt once we go. The trip will be for you. But that's not to say you're going to be totally bored in the meantime. We'll probably get attacked at any moment."
"Really?"
"Well, it's more likely going to be after we leave the store." Oberon's ears perked up and he turned to the door.
"Someone's coming."
A customer walked in, looking for a copy of the Upanishads, and after that a fairly steady stream of people were either browsing or buying something. The lunchtime lull was over, and soon enough Perry came back to help out. After giving a regular his customary cup of Daddy's Little Helper, my code for a tea designed to promote prostate health, the phone rang. It was a call from one of Radomiwa's coven.
"Mr. O'Sullivan, my name is Malina Sokolowski. May I speak to you about what occurred between you and Emily this afternoon?"
"Well, sure, but I cannot speak frankly right now. I have customers in the store."
"I understand," she replied.
She had a warm voice and a faint accent that had to be Polish, judging by her name.
"Let me ask you this. Do you consider the contract between you and Emily to still be in effect?"
"Oh, absolutely." I nodded as if she could see it. "Nothing happened to nullify that."
"That is reassuring. Would you mind terribly if I accompanied her for tomorrow's tea?"
"I suppose that would depend on your intentions."
"I will not fence with you," Malina said.
What was this coven's obsession with fencing?
"My intention is to defend Emily in case you attack her again."
"I see. And according to Emily, how many times have I attacked her so far?"
"Once physically and once magically."
"Well, at least she got that part right. But in both cases, Malina, it was she who initiated the attack. I was able to redirect both attacks against her, hence the injuries you have no doubt seen."
"So it's her word against yours?"
She sighed. "Yes, and I understand that you must take her word against mine, but you must understand that she told me her lover is a sworn enemy of mine. By doing so, she has allied your entire coven with him."
"No, that is unthinkable," Malina objected. "If we were allied with this individual, then we would not be trying to humiliate him."
"Why are you trying to humiliate him?"
"That is a question better answered by Radomiwa."
"So put her on. Is she there?"
"Radomiwa is indisposed."
For normal people, that would mean she was taking a shower or something. In Radomiwa's case, it probably meant she was in the middle of a complicated spell involving Tongue of Frog, Eye of Newt, and maybe a packet of Splenda. "I see." A customer with greasy black hair hanging over his face came up to the counter with a bulk bag of incense sticks. "Look, I have to go. You're welcome to come with Emily tomorrow, but it would be best to counsel her to keep silent around me. I can make her tea in silence, and she can drink it in silence. That way no one will get offended or injured. If you'd like to stay behind afterward, perhaps we can talk without coming to blows." Malina agreed, said she looked forward to it, and we rang off. The greasy man asked me if I had access to medical marijuana as an apothecary, and I pasted a sorrowful expression on my face and told him no as I rang up the incense he needed to mask the stink of his habit. Drug addicts perplex me. They're a relatively recent development, historically speaking. Everyone has their theories. Monotheists like to blame it on godlessness. But I think it was a plague that developed in the sooty petticoats of the Industrial Revolution and its concomitant division of labor. Once people specialized their labors and separated themselves from food production and the daily needs of basic survival, there was a hollow place in their lives that they did not know how to fill. Most people found healthy ways to fill it, with hobbies or social clubs or pseudo-sports like shuffleboard and tiddlywinks. Others didn't. Perry finally found some time to mess around with the tarot decks and had a serviceable display up by closing time. I rode quickly to the widow's house after locking up the store and retrieved the push mower from her shed in the backyard.
"Ah, you're a fine boy, Atticus, and that's no lie,"
she said, saluting me with her whiskey glass as she came out to the front porch to watch me work. She liked to sit in her rocking chair and sing old Irish songs to me, old for her anyway, over the whirl of the lawnmower blades. Sometimes she would forget the words and simply hum the tune, and I enjoyed that just as much. When I was finished, I always spent a pleasant time with her, hearing stories of her younger days in the old country. That day, as the sun was setting and the shadows were lengthening, she was telling me something about running around the streets of Dublin with a bunch of ne'er-do-wells.
"This was all before I met me husband, of course,"
she made sure to add. I had Oberon stationed as sentinel on the edge of the lawn close to the street. As the widow regaled me with tales of her golden age debauchery, I was depending on him to tell me of approaching danger.
"Atticus,"
he said as the widow was winding up her tale with a sigh over better days in a better land.
"Someone comes on foot from the north."
"Is he a stranger?" I had put Fragora aside while I talked to the widow, but now I stood and slung the scabbard back over my head, causing the widow to frown.
"Yes, he is very strange. I can smell the ocean on him from here."
Uh-oh. That's not good. Stay still and try not to make any noise. "Excuse me, Mrs. McDonough," I said. "Someone's coming and he might not be friendly."
"What? Who is it, Atticus?"
I couldn't answer yet, so I didn't. I kicked off my sandals and drew power from the widow's lawn even as I walked toward the street and peered northward. One of the charms on my necklace has the shape of a bear on it, and its function is to store a bit of magical power for me that I can tap when I'm walking on concrete or asphalt. I topped off the magical tank as a possible antagonist approached. A tall, armored figure clanked noisily on the asphalt a couple of houses away, and it raised a hand to hail me when I came into view. I activated a different charm that I call Fairy Specs, a sort of filter for my eyes that lets me see through fey glamours and detect all sorts of magic juju. It showed me the normal spectrum, but then there was also a green overlay that revealed what was going on magically, and right now the two layers showed me the same thing, so whoever he was, I was looking at his true form. If he had something similar to my fairy specs, he might be able to see through Oberon's camouflage, but then again he might not. He was wearing rather gaudy bronze armor that no one would have worn in the old days. The cuirass, faced in hardened leather dyed with woad, covered too much and restricted movement. He had leaf-shaped tassets hanging down over a bronze mail skirt. He also had 5-piece pauldrons and matching vambraces and greaves. It would have been hot enough to wear such armor in Ireland, but here the temperature was still in the low 90s, and he must have been broiling in it. His helmet was beyond ridiculous. It was one of those medieval barbutes that didn't become popular until 1,000 years after his halcyon days of slaughter, and he must have been wearing it as a joke, though I did not find it especially funny. A sword hung in a scabbard at his side, but thankfully he did not carry a shield.
"I greet you, Siohan O'Sullivan," he said. "Well met."
He flashed a smug grin at me through his helmet, and I wanted to slay him on the spot. I kept my fairy specs on because I simply didn't trust him. Without some way to pierce his glamour, he could make my eyes think he was standing 3 feet away with his hands on his head while he was really plunging a dagger into my belly. "Call me Atticus. I greet you, Bress."
"Not well met?"
He tilted his head a bit to the right, as much as the barbute would let him. "Let's see how the meeting goes. It's been a long time since we've seen each other, and I wouldn't have minded if it were longer. And by the way, the Renaissance Festival doesn't arrive here until next February.
That's not very hospitable, Bress said, frowning.
Oberon was right. He smelled of salt and fish. As a god of agriculture, he should smell of earth and flowers, but instead he retained the stink of the dockside, owing perhaps to his Fomorian ancestors who lived by the sea.
I could take offense if I wished.
So take it already and be done. I can't imagine why else you would be here now.
I am here at the request of an old friend, he said.
Did he request that you dress like that? Because if he did, he's not your friend.
Atticus, who is that?
The widow McDonough called from her porch. I didn't take my eyes off Bress as I called back to her. Someone I know. He won't be staying long. Time to set up my flanking maneuver. Speaking mind to mind, I said to Oberon, remain still, but when I say get behind him, grab a leg and just yank him off his feet. Once he's down, jump clear.
Got it, Oberon said.
Bress continued as if the widow had never spoken.
Angus Og wants the sword. Give it to me and you'll be left alone. It's that simple.
Why isn't he here himself?
He's nearby, Bress said.
That was calculated to ratchet my paranoia up a few levels. It worked, but I was determined it would not work in his favor. What's your stake in this, Bress?
And what's with the armor? That does not concern you, Druid. Your only concern is whether you will agree to give us the sword and live, or refuse and die.
The last fingers of the sun were waving goodbye over the horizon, and twilight was upon us. Fairy time. Tell me why he wants it, I said. It's not like Ireland has a high king who needs the Tuatha De Danann to help him out uniting all the various tribes.
It is not for you to question.
Sure it is, I said. But I guess it's not for you to answer. Fregora's right here. I gestured to the hilt peeking over my shoulder. So if I give it to you now, you walk away, and I never hear from you or Angus again? Bress peered intently at the hilt for a few moments, then chuckled.
That is not Fragara. I have seen it, Druid, and I have felt its magic. You have nothing in that scabbard but an ordinary sword.
Wow. Radomiwa's magical cloak just rocked. And then the green overlay in my vision started to differ from the normal spectrum. Bress was pulling his sword out of his scabbard in a leisurely fashion and watching my face to see if I reacted, so I tried to stay relaxed and let him think I was clueless. Either he knew that I really had Fragara on my back and he wanted to double-cross me, or he simply wanted to kill me to burnish his reputation. He'd make a fine tale of the battle, no doubt, in spite of the fact that he was planning the equivalent of a stab in the back. I assure you it's the real thing, I said to him. And to Oberon I said, change in plan. Just lie down behind him when I say. I'll push him over your back so he falls down.
Okay.
Bress's glamour form shrugged and said,
you can give your cheap sword to me if you'd like. It'll only delay things, and I'll have to come back again with another offer. But I can guarantee that offer won't be as generous as the one I'm giving you now.
And that was when the true Bress on the green overlay grinned wickedly and raised his sword over his head in a two-handed grasp, ready to split me in two.
Now, Oberon,
I said, keeping my face pensive as if I were thinking over Bress's words. I started talking out loud to hopefully mask any sounds Oberon made as he moved. Bress, I think you're missing something important, I said, even as he brought his sword down with all his strength and I stepped out of the way to the right at the last instant. His glamour persona was still standing there smirking, but I didn't pay attention to that one anymore. The green one, the real Bress, had just tried to slay me. While he was hunched over awkwardly on his follow-through, I kicked at the nerve cluster in his wrist to make him drop the sword, then put another one in his face to make him stand back up. It didn't get through his helmet, but any blow to the head is going to make you pull away. Then I pivoted on my left foot and spun clockwise, delivering a roundhouse into his solar plexus before he could set himself. He staggered backward and fell over Oberon in a tremendous clatter of bronze and hardened leather, still not hurt, but pretty humiliated by this point. He gave up on the glamour, and the smirking Bress merged with the one on the ground, so that my fairy specs and my normal vision showed the same thing again. I could have left it there. He was disarmed and no danger to me now, and if any of the Fae had been around to see him fall flat on his ass, he would be shamed in a legendary fashion. Except that he had tried to kill me with a glamour. He would never fight me fairly, because he could not win that way. He'd never been much of a terror on the battlefield. If I let him live, then he would send a series of assassins my way, just as Angus Oak had been doing for centuries. I didn't need twice the headache I already had. Plus, in the parlance of our times, he was a douchebag. So I didn't leave it there. While he was still on the ground, I whipped Fragora out of its scabbard and plunged it straight through the center of his bronze cuirass, which offered no resistance to the magical blade. Bress's eyes bulged, and he stared at me in disbelief. After surviving the epic battles of ancient Ireland, in respectable armor, during which he could have died heroically, he was going to meet his end in a fight that lasted less than 10 seconds because of his own overconfidence. I didn't gloat over him, because that's how people get cursed. I yanked Fragora out of him quickly, causing him to gasp in pain, and then I brought the sword down on his neck, severing his head before he could utter a death curse against me.
"When he said to give him the sword, I don't think he meant for you to stick it in his guts,"
Oberon said. He took a swipe at me with his sword. I replied.
"He did? Well, I didn't see that."
"He didn't see you either. Well done."
"You killed him,"
I heard a tiny voice say. I turned to see the widow standing up, whiskey glass trembling in her hand before it slipped out and shattered on her porch.
"You killed him."
Her voice quavered.
"Are you gonna kill me too now? Send me home to the Lord so I can be with me son."
"No, Mrs. McDonough, no, of course not." I resheathed Fragora to remove the thread it represented, even though the blade wasn't clean. "I have no reason to kill you."
"I am a witness to your crime."
"It wasn't a crime. I had to kill him. It was self-defense."
"It didn't look like self-defense to me," she said. "You kicked him and pushed him, and then you stabbed him and cut off his head."
"I don't think you saw the whole thing," I replied, shaking my head, "because I was partially blocking your view. He tried to stab me with his sword. See it lying there on the ground? I didn't pull that out of its scabbard. He did." I stayed where I was and let her process it. When someone thinks you might kill them, the last thing you want to do is edge closer to them in an attempt to comfort them, but people always seem to do it in the movies. The widow squinted at the dim outline of the sword, and I watched the doubt seep into her expression.
"I thought I heard him threaten you,"
she said.
"But I didn't see him move until you kicked him. Who was he? What did he want?"
"He's an old enemy of mine," I began, and the widow interrupted.
"Old enemy? Aren't you only 21? How old could your enemies be?"
Gods below, she really had no idea. "He was old in the way I see things," I said. And then I thought of a story to tell her. "He was really an old enemy of my father's, so he's been my enemy from the day I was born, if you see what I mean. And after my father passed away years ago, I became the target instead. That's why I moved here, you know, to get away from him. But I heard a couple days ago that he had found me and was coming, so I started wearing this sword to protect myself."
"Why didn't you get yourself a gun like all these American boys do?"
I grinned at her. "Because I'm Irish, Mrs. McDonough. And I'm your friend." I modulated my expression to earnest pleading and clasped my hands together. "Please, you have to believe me. I had to kill him or be killed myself. And I hope you know that I would never, ever hurt you." She was still unconvinced, but was wavering.
"What was the nature of the argument he had with your da?"
she asked. I couldn't fabricate a plausible lie on the spot, so I told her a part of the truth. "It was about this sword, actually," I said, jerking my thumb back to the hilt. "Da stole it from him long ago, but in a way it's more like he brought it home. It's an Irish sword, you know, but this bloke had it in his private collection, and it didn't seem right, him being British and all."
"He's British?"
"Aye." I felt ashamed for pushing the widow's buttons like this, but I couldn't afford to keep talking all night with a decapitated body in the street. Her husband had been in the provost during the Troubles and was killed by the UVF, whom the widow had always assumed, rightly or not, to be puppets of the British.
"Ah! Well, then you can bury the bastard in me backyard, and goddamn the queen and all her hellish minions."
"Amen," I said, "and thank you."
Not at all, me boy,
the widow said, and then she laughed.
You know what Michonne used to say, God rest his soul? He said, a friend will help you move, Katie, but a really good friend will help you move a body.
She cackled hoarsely and clapped her hands together.
Not that I can help you move a big bugger like that. Do you know where the shuffle is?
Aye, that I do. I wonder, Mrs. McDonough, if you would have some lemonade or something in the house? I have a feeling I'll need it.
Oh, sure, me boy. I can whip something up. You just get busy and I'll come out with a glass.
Thank you so much. As she disappeared inside, I turned back to Oberon, who was still in camouflage. Think you can carry the head back to the backyard? We need to get this out of sight. Night had fallen, but the street lamps were coming on, and anyone driving down the street would see a slight problem in their headlights.
Not much to grab onto with that helmet on. I guess I could nudge it along with my nose.
Good enough.